The headlines, Moscow says it has taken control of a city in southern Ukraine, while Kiev claims some 6,000 Russian troops have lost their lives during the seven-day conflict. President Biden bans Russian flights from U.S. skies, blaming Russia's President Vladimir Putin for the anti-Moscow sanctions. The first Ukrainian refugees have started arriving in Italy after Russia launched a military operation in Ukraine last week. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, it's the seventh day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, with major cities, including the capital Kiev, being the target of attacks. Clashes have erupted in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, where Russian airborne troops have landed. The city's authorities say over the past 24 hours, nearly two dozen people were killed and over 100 others wounded in shelling attacks. In the capital Kiev, an airstrike on the main television tower has killed five people. Russian forces have also taken full control of the regional center of the Black Sea city of Kherson. In fresh remarks, Ukraine's president has claimed almost 6,000 Russians have lost their lives during the ongoing conflict. So far, no comments from Russian officials. Vladimir Zelensky also says Moscow cannot win the war with bombs and rockets, but Russia's defense minister earlier pledged to push ahead with the operation until all the objectives are achieved. Hours ago, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will all be united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war on Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said Washington, with the help of its allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia, and he even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his own words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Jerome Hughes is joining us now from Brussels. Jerome, welcome to the program. Please bring us up to speed on all the latest developments regarding the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and also some of the latest European reactions and responses to the conflict so far.
Yes, Bardia. Well, I think that much of the focus now over the next coming days will be on continuing the preparation for sanctions, continuing the preparation to arm Ukraine, but also about the whole issue of refugees and migrant flows from Ukraine. I mean, the UN is estimating that 660,000 people have already fled the country, and the vast majority of those going to Poland. So you're talking about something in the region of 450,000 people. And as we speak, the European Council President, Charles Michel, who sort of represents the 27 heads of government in the EU, he's actually in Poland to assess the situation. And of course, apart from Poland, they're going to other EU nations, so talking about Slovakia, Romania and Hungary, and also non-EU country Moldova. So that is a growing focus of the attention. And actually, tomorrow, Thursday, and also Friday, Home Affairs ministers are going to be meeting here in Brussels. There's also, over the next 2 days, going to be a meeting Thursday and Friday of the EU Affairs ministers. And again, much of the focus is in relation to the people who are fleeing Ukraine and the possible supports that can be given. But it is interesting, of course, countries like Poland and Hungary Hungary have traditionally been very anti-refugee. And so, you know, this now suddenly they find that it's basically on their doorstep. And as I say, a big focus as well, I mean, you have, even in the European Commission alone, you have 30,000 civil servants, public servants, and then you have obviously a lot for the European Council and the European Parliament and so on. So you have a huge number of people working on trying to formulate and get these sanctions together relating to a whole range of areas. So work on the sanctions is continuing. And as I said, the military escalation from the EU's perspective, I mean, they provided, as we heard on Sunday, 500,000, so half a billion euro to Ukraine. The vast majority of that is going on military hardware like anti-tank weapons and so on. So again, that doesn't happen overnight. Progress on that is working. And as we keep making the point, the big question is, you know, if Russia does suffer considerable losses in terms of fatalities, for example, with the military as a result of Ukraine being armed by the West, well, how might Moscow respond? How could this escalate further? And that is a major concern.
Thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is rattling global markets, with oil prices surging to seven-year highs amid supply disruption fears over the economic sanctions on Moscow. Brent crude oil has surged past $110 per barrel. Also, U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude is up by 5% at above $108. OPEC and other major producers, including Russia, will hold a meeting to discuss increasing output to control price rises. On Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, which includes the U.S., agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves and try and curb soaring prices. But a disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil suppliers, could send prices even higher. Also, Asian stocks declined as investors fretted about the impact of sanctions on Russia. Observers are concerned that the disruption caused by the sanctions could have a deep negative impact on global growth and inflation. The first Ukrainian refugees have started arriving in Italy after Russia launched a military operation in Ukraine last week. Meanwhile, African refugees have been pushed back when trying to cross the border with Poland. Here's a look.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in four Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted. Also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally.
About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It is a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, to further our focus on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, we're now joined by Lambert Opik, former member of UK Parliament, joining us from London. Also, we have author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Opik. in London. Sir, I'd like to get your perspective on what were the main circumstances and reasons that have led to the situation that we're in right now.
This situation has been growing for at least 8 years. And although the rest of the media doesn't really like to highlight the other side, there are major issues which have probably driven Putin into taking this action. It wasn't a surprise. I was in Bulgaria last week, and they weren't surprised. They thought that this was inevitable to an extent. Fundamentally, the question really is, can Putin achieve objectives in terms of protecting the interests of Russians and those who identify as Russians in the Ukraine by taking this military action? Now, that remains to be seen. But the big question, of course, then is how will NATO and how will the West respond to this? Really, we need to be consistent. The West has often used military action to fight its cases. So we need cool heads, not hot wars. But we also have to recognize there is a real debate to be had. This isn't just one-sided in terms of what was the original motivation, which is all about the interests of Russians and people who identify with Moscow in Ukraine.
John Stepling, in retrospect, do you think that the U.S. and NATO could have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Were all options, in your views, were they exhausted? Were all avenues treaded to prevent the conflict between Russia and Ukraine?
No, I think quite the opposite. I mean, if you go back to 2014, and John Mearsheimer gave a brilliant lecture in 2015 predicting everything that was going to happen and blaming the U.S. Look, the U.S., from the moment that the Bucharest Declaration took place and Ukraine and Georgia became candidates for membership in NATO, this was inevitable. It was never going to be acceptable to Russia to have NATO military bases on its border, and they share a very long border with Ukraine. Of course, it goes back before that to the elections in Ukraine in 2004, 2010. The country has always been badly split between the West and the East. The West are ethnic Ukrainians. They speak Ukrainian in the East. They are mostly Russian speakers and identify with Russia. After that, of course, Putin saw the danger of a NATO military base in Crimea, so Russia took control of Crimea, which was a completely rational thing to do. You have to understand that for those in Moscow and in Beijing, the idea of the U.S. spreading democracy doesn't mean the same thing. The U.S. idea of spreading democracy means, you know, creating protests in Hong Kong. That's what Beijing sees when you mention spreading democracy. And Putin sees, rightly, the expansion of NATO eastward. And it happened in 1999. And then again in 2008, I guess it was, and you see all of these countries, Bulgaria, Latvia, Estonia, the small Baltic states actually share a border with Russia, but they're very small countries and you know, pale in significance compared to Ukraine. So the U.S. was provoking this response all along. I mean, this was kind of the great chessboard idea again. They ultimately wanted regime change in Moscow. That may sound delusional, but the West is often delusional. What has been shocking, however, has been the kind of commentary coming out of governments in the West, in Scandinavia, in Germany, France, Spain, all of these places, and people flying, you know, yellow and blue flags and so forth. aggression against Yemen never made a dent in Western consciousness. Nobody ever flew Yemeni flags. They don't fly Palestinian flags either. But suddenly they identify with Ukraine because that's been the propaganda. The U.S. has launched an absolutely massive propaganda campaign to demonize Putin, claim that Putin wants a greater Russia, that he identifies with Peter the Great or something. All of this kind of after the fact propaganda, which has no basis in reality. The U.S. provoked this. You can't expect that Russia was going to tolerate Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. And then you have the 2014 coup that put a Nazi-infected party in power in Ukraine. And Donbass, which is ethnically Russian, Russian speakers in the east, has been enduring eight years of shelling. And I don't know how many thousands of civilians died. That also made no dent in Western consciousness. So we're seeing just a sort of shocking one-sided narrative being constructed that is demonizing Putin and Russia. And the contrary is actually the case.
All right. Thanks a lot. In-depth coverage of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Thanks to former member of UK Parliament and Press TV presenter Lembit Opik joining us from London. Also thanks to author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Moving on, Iran says a bitter experience it's had with the U.S.'s non-compliance and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 agreement has prompted it to push for a reliable and sustainable deal in the Vienna talks. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, made those comments during a meeting with a number of lawmakers. Shamkhani said in addition to putting forth efforts to remove the sanctions, Iran is also focusing its strategy on neutralizing the effects of those sanctions. The lawmakers present at the session also called for the Iranian negotiating team to keep pushing so that a possible final agreement would compensate the Iranian people for the losses they've incurred. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's latest comments about Iranian nuclear scientists is drawing outrage from Iranian officials. Tehran's permanent representative to the U.N. describes the remarks as provocative and terror-inciting. Majid Takht-e Avanchi says Graham's comments are an invitation to additional terrorist acts against Iranian scientists. The U.N. ambassador described the remarks as repulsive, abhorrent, and reprehensible. He says such rhetoric only serves as a green light to the Israeli regime to perpetrate more terrorist acts against Iranian nuclear scientists. In an interview in mid-February, Graham said, a lot of Iranian scientists have had a lot of accidents, adding the U.S. would expect even more accidents to come. Several Iranian scientists have been assassinated in Israeli terrorist operations in Iran, the last one being Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who lost his life in a targeted killing near Tehran in November 2020. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
32.
2만.
2만. 미안해.
Bazaar. Archaeologists discovered one of the oldest medical devices dating back 9,000 years ago. The device is a flint-tipped drill and bowstrings used by Neolithic dentists in the Balochistan area of Pakistan. Nowadays, medical devices are far more advanced but carry the same importance in healthcare. Innovative products can replace, repair, and sustain failing body functions. These items can also have intelligence that allows health practitioners to remotely monitor a patient's conditions. Today, thanks to technology, there are more accessible treatments for a wide variety of diseases with more efficient care for the sick person.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connects us nationally and internationally. This time, we're going to check out the contributions of knowledge-based companies to the health sector. We wanted to see what types of products are made. Plus, we will briefly touch on what goes into making medical devices that save the lives of people, especially during the pandemic. Let's start the show. To familiarize ourselves with medical device production, we visited a knowledge-based company that specializes in making advanced technology for hospitals and clinics. Puyandegone Rahe Saadat was first established nearly three decades ago and has been actively producing products in seven categories. Its products are used to monitor health or treat critically ill patients in hospitals. Among its achievements, one can name the 247 plan in collaboration with the Ministry of Health. This was a program that connects ambulances carrying patients to hospital emergency rooms. This knowledge-based company designed a portable cardiograph machine that is carried on ambulances. The advantage of these devices is they can save sensitive heart images. The information is sent directly to the emergency room for analysis as the patient is on their way. Plus, the device can receive calls and medical doctors can speak with patients and provide on-the-spot instructions. Such a system has saved thousands of lives. The research and development department holds the pulse of this company. Here, quality control checks are carried and standardization criteria are implemented. It is also where new products are born. Among its hundreds of employees, this company uses the knowledge and expertise of a slew of various engineers to make advanced products from seemingly simple ideas. Medical devices are a fundamental part of healthcare systems. They are essential to prevent, diagnose, treat, and rehabilitate illnesses and diseases safely and effectively. Because they deal with human life, these items need to always be dependable, safe, and accurate with zero failure. That is why medical devices must follow extremely strict standards for production and also performance.
Some 20 years ago, this company obtained EU standardization licenses and has since produced its products along with European standards. It also adheres to the strict requirements of the Ministry of Health and the National Medical Device Directorate. This company has massive production halls that are closely monitored. The processes of quality control checks are taken very seriously as these tests ensure the high quality of products made in this place.
Each component of any device is checked for quality before it is even applied. All stages of production are continuously examined and tested to ensure the final assembly produces the best outcome. But that's not where quality control stops. The final products are also tested and examined for accurate performance. It might be interesting to know that this company has been exporting its products to dozens of countries around the globe. This knowledge-based business has never stopped looking to the future. As part of its vision, it plans to develop its products to increase its capabilities and diversity. Moreover, it plans on increasing its export reach. As with any business when starting out, there are always challenges to overcome, and one of the hurdles for this company was the U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. But instead of allowing the sanctions to become a thorn in its side, this company turned it into an opportunity for growth. Over the past two decades, Iran has taken huge strides in the health and medical sector. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing at a rate that is above the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 of its medical devices to show for it. This technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced machinery used in the medical sector. Out of the 1,000 medical device manufacturers in the country, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These manufacturers generate some 30% of revenues in medical device market. That's based on statistics from the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology of Iran. Going off the figures from the Medical Equipment Office at the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced in the country. All of these products meet EU standardization requirements. To get a better idea of just how advanced this sector really is, we looked at some data from the National Medical Device Directorate. Figures showed that over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions. Domestic medical device production has developed by leaps and bounds since 2019. Productions have reduced imports by 10%. Meanwhile, exports of these items have also increased by 10% over the last 3 years. These figures come from the Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health. The National Medical Device Directorate said Iran's medical device productions were worth nearly $3 billion in 2018. Current official figures have not been made public yet, but industry participants predict Iran's share of this market will be roughly $7 billion by 2025. The significant progress in medical device production has been largely due to government support for manufacturers and knowledge-based companies. Knowledge-based companies are peeling away the fingers of the U.S. monopoly on medical equipment and pharmaceuticals by manufacturing sanctioned items. Doing so has reduced imports and saved the country large amounts of foreign currency while meeting domestic needs. The U.S. government claims that the sanctions do not include medicine and medical equipment. But sanctions have made it virtually impossible for Iran to import vital medicine and medical devices. During tough times, at the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the Ministry of Health turned to knowledge-based companies for much-needed innovations to save people's lives. Companies, like the one we mentioned earlier, stepped up to the plate and began manufacturing items like ventilators. Since the beginning of the outbreak, domestic firms have been making testing kits, vaccines, medicine, and other strategic products. Currently, 5 coronavirus vaccines have been domestically manufactured, all of which have completed required clinical trials and are offered to the public after being approved by the Health Ministry. Iran is one of the few countries in the world that has the capabilities to produce vaccines. Not only has Iran fully met the country's needs, but it also has the capacity to export COVID-19-related treatments and testing products. Historically, each epoch has a particular industrial growth spurt. At present, what we are witnessing is another industrial shift but this time it is towards knowledge-based products. These items have allowed several processes in our lives and industries to become faster and more efficient. For example, medical devices such as the hemodialysis machine have helped treat illnesses that were previously lost causes. The development of knowledge-based products is also important for the preservation of the environment and protecting it from harmful matter such as industrial waste. It's hard to imagine what our lives would look like without these items. This time, we are going to venture through Iwan's knowledge-based productions. We will uncover who makes these products and why they are important to all industries in the country. We will also check out how the government is supporting knowledge-based companies in developing new advanced technologies. This time, our journey took us to the city of Apar in Zanjan province, where we visited Fanovaron Zistkore. This knowledge-based company was established nearly a decade ago and is active in three fields of laboratory work, research, and production of advanced machinery. The beating heart of this company is its advanced lab, which is trusted and certified by the National Environmental Protection Agency. Plus, it's part of the country's strategic technology lab network. Its labs are equipped with environmental monitoring technology as well as other instruments to carry out specialized research. Currently, its extensive lab cooperates closely with various industries, including hospitals in the field of environmental pollution monitoring, and acts as a research center for future innovations. This knowledge-based company provides many research services through its laboratories. For example, it previously carried out research projects in the field of oil refinery liquid waste. Another project was research on the treatment of synthetic resin sewage discharge using synthesized photocatalytic nanocomposites. These are used to gauge and remove pollutants in liquids for purification purposes. This company actively exchanges scientific information both nationally and internationally and regularly publishes its findings in academic journals at home and abroad. It collaborates with academic institutions and other research-based firms, providing them with test results. The government has been shifting more and more towards a knowledge-based economy that thrives on research. So knowledge spillover plays a big role in entrepreneurship, especially in cross-discipline research. Having labs in the country dedicated to advancing specialized research is very important. These types of knowledge-based companies help expand products in the market that may have been previously imported. It was the first company in the country to apply science for manufacturing wastewater treatment and purification. Its manufacturing workshops are massive, with a cumulative area of over a hectare to produce the giant water treatment systems. Its machinery is used in industrial settings where water is refined and returned to the system for reuse. Furthermore, its machinery has helped preserve valuable water resources nationwide. Some sectors that apply this technology are the food industry. In general, all industries that use water to produce their products are the end user of this company's water purification machinery. All of the technology produced here is manufactured along the lines of European standards. Its capabilities and products have been exported to regional areas, including Europe. As part of its future goals, this company wants to expand its product list and increase its exports. It's noteworthy that this company has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Among its staff, this company employs the capabilities of environmental engineers, among other experts, on its roster. Among its many competitive advantages, one can name the high-quality material that is used for productions of its water purification systems. But that's not all. This company has played a big role in creating technology that preserves all the fine qualities of water using advanced machines for purifications. Iran has been supporting the shift to a knowledge-based society by implementing plans that empower companies in their efforts to develop advanced technology. In fact, in 2010, the government passed laws promoting and supporting knowledge-based companies as part of a legal framework. This has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many social and economic advantages. In 2013, there were only 50 knowledge-based firms and startups. That figure has grown over the years to well over 6,000 companies, according to the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology. A diverse range of products is manufactured by these firms to meet the country's rising domestic demands. This has saved the country millions of dollars by reducing expensive imports. Iran makes thousands of different types of specialized technologies. The amount of progress of knowledge-based firms in the fields of medical devices, energy, and information communication technology is the most noticeable. Aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals are among other disciplines researchers are focusing on. And exports of knowledge-based products are estimated to reach over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's based on figures from the Science and Technology Office. The National Innovation Fund says tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. Some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market as well. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. Some of these schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports. Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups. High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries, and continents. They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings, and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear colleague and friend who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's go check it out.
One of the amazing outcomes of the IT sector is that we no longer need to stand in long queues to get our daily affairs done, such as financial transactions or even getting a cab. But that amazing feature has not come about on its own. It's thanks to dedicated companies like ITSaaS that we enjoy the growing benefits of the IT sector. Launched in 2016, the fledgling Iranian brand offers a range of online services. Governments are increasingly shifting from physical to e-services to facilitate administrative procedures for their citizens. ITSaaS has put this issue on top of its agenda and has pushed the envelope on e-government services. The Iranian brand has tasked itself to be entirely independent of foreign technologies. ITSaaS says its products and services are developed from A to Z by Iranian experts. The zeros and ones are permeating every aspect of our lives, and the Iranian IT company says it seeks to build smart cities in Iran with the goal of building a smarter life with AI. With its 200 dedicated experts, ITSaaS thinks big. It seeks to export its services to other countries to both find a foothold in the global market and promote e-services in the world. As it says, aside from making our lives easier, a smarter world translates into a greener environment.
For our final segment of the program, let's take a look at some news and developments in the realm of healthcare. From printing hip replacements to even hearts, there is so much more to discover with 3D technologies. Now, a group of Iranian scientists has built a three-dimensional scanner that can scan the entire body in less than 1 minute.
In seconds, the scanner collects information from millions of body parts by using infrared radiation. It then measures different physical parameters, such as height or weight, to provide other information. The scanner captures the position of the body in reality and registers data in virtual reality through light or laser beam. This technology is a precise way to monitor body changes.
The Iranian government has been stepping up its support for knowledge-based productions, and this year, the number of loans paid to knowledge-based firms has sharply risen.
Loans paid by banks were up by nearly 130% in the first 10 months of this year compared to the year before. The domestic banking system paid nearly $2 billion of facilities to 1,200 knowledge-based companies. That's based on figures from Iran's central bank. The government developed schemes to bolster their efforts in productions. Productions in these companies have already reduced several bottlenecks in various industries.
An Iranian knowledge-based company has produced insulin pens, which have been released into the market after months of sanctions-driven shortages.
The developer says they have commercialized the device, which is a long-acting insulin pen that patients inject every 24 hours. Currently, 1 million of these products received approval from the Ministry of Health and can be found in pharmacies across the country. The shortage in recent months created problems for scores of patients struggling to maintain their diabetes. Experts say U.S. sanctions have spurred a boom in the domestic manufacturing sector. This is while the government is diversifying the economy away from oil revenues.
That covers our program for today. Thank you for tuning in. I will see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We know that when it does come to the topic of charity, we hold it, this topic very close to our hearts, because we want to be as human as possible with our feelings. And Islam does encourage us very much to be not only compassionate, but stand in solidarity with those who are around us who are not as fortunate as you and I. And that's why sadaqah is given in different levels. Depending on your financial capacity, depending on what it is that you are able to do or have. And that's why we said that there are many applications of sadaqah. Doesn't necessarily need to be money. For example, you are in university and you know that there's a poor family, and the poor family can't afford to have a tutor. You tutor their children. That's the best form of sadaqah, like all the other very, very good forms of sadaqah. So we need to expand in our understanding of what sadaqah represents. And all of it is for the sake of other people who are around you. You want to elevate their status in the society. You want to improve their welfare. You want to make sure that medication is facilitated for them, or water, or anything else along those lines. And of course, that's really, really heart lifting. You know, it does really give you that motivation that you need. And that's why there are many effects for sadaqah. And we did say that sadaqah repels evil. We did say that sadaqah removes a bad omen from you, removes your nuhusa. If you were to build a Husayniya, that's the best sadaqah jariyah. And all these other wonderful examples of sadaqah. Now, on the other side, the receiver, the person who is poor, do they demand sadaqah? Do they beg on the streets? Here, what is the Islamic approach? We know that Islam makes sure that as Muslims, we need to have the highest level of izzatun nafs, of self-respect, self-honor, self-esteem. And we never allow ourselves to be degraded or humiliated by ourselves or by someone else. And therefore, when a person does get to that stage of begging, that is them humiliating themselves. And that's why al-istijda', begging, is something reprehensible by our religion, Islam. A person doesn't need to get to that stage, of course, because hopefully, as Muslims, we are accommodating to the financial needs of people who are around us. And we know, unfortunately, we also know for a fact that there are many people out there who are fake, who are not genuine, who are probably richer than you, probably gain an income higher than you, but yet they have accustomed themselves to begging on the streets, unfortunately. And even as far as a city is concerned, it's not a very nice kind of image for the city to allow beggars to roam around. And of course, this also leads to many, many other social problems, like mafia groups with begging, theft through begging, and all of these other issues, fraud and everything else, unfortunately. Of course, when it does come to you being needless, this is a very important, noble kind of position that someone should have. But interestingly, is we need to understand that we should not be allowing ourselves to lower our value by putting out, extending our hand out and, you know, becoming a beggar.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, Inna Allaha yuhibbu al-muhayyi al-muta'affif. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves a chaste, modest person. Wa yubghidhu al-badhi al-sa'il al-mulhif. And he hates a person who is vulgar in their language, of course, and also someone who asks in the sense of begging in that particular sense. Shi'ati, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he also says, from among the descriptions of who a Shi'i is, Shi'ati man, so-and-so-and-so-and-so, lam yas'al innas walau mata ju'an. A Shi'i is someone who will never ask people, even if it means that they're going to die out of hunger. So from our side, as, you know, people who want to be kind and nice and generous and pay sadaqah, we need to make sure that we accommodate to the needs of people. From the other side, someone who is in need, you know, inshallah, their risk will come to them. But if they get to that stage of begging, then of course that is where everything is going to fall apart for them. And that's why, you know, it's not something in any way endorsed or approved of socially or Islamically, especially in the case of you are not able to verify the genuinity of their cases. Now, when it comes to why we need to deal with the issue of beggars and these kind of things, there's a variety of ahadith that Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam speak about as far as why a person who does ask for money and they're not poor, why would they be, for example, seemed as being condemned in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? From Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, it says, مَنْ يَسْأَلْ مِنْ غَيْرِ فَقْرٍ فَكَأَنَّمَا يَأْكُلُ الْجَمْرِ. Someone who asks at the time not being poor, that it is like as if they are eating, they are consuming coal. Variety of other things can be mentioned about this, but we will leave it at that. وَالْحَمْدُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَالصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَىٰ سَيِّدِنَا مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِهِ الطَّاهِرِينَ.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.